you have to make a Faustian bargain with the devil in order to get that skill, is what people will joke about. In reality, the people who are good at it, in general, have 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship in the antenna testing laboratory before they really understand what's going on. There are lots of people who say those words, and they mean it. So unless you're under the right wing of the right mentor who is teaching you antenna testing procedures, there's only 30 ways you can go wrong and come up with measurements that you think are great, but you've been fibbing to yourself, if you know what I mean. So you have to picture what's going on. That signal, when it's radiated by that antenna, goes into every possible angle in space, reflects off everything that you can see and don't see. Those signals, all of those reflecting signals, are going from point A, the transmitter, to point B, the receiver. All those paths are there simultaneously. Each one of them is an individual voltage vector. And the way the receiving antenna works is Mother Nature will let you take each of those voltage vectors where you're looking at amplitude and phase angle, and you add them together. That's the composite signal you get. And no matter how good you think you have set up your range, and you think you've knocked down the echoes, you've decreased them, you've removed a good number of the decibels of ambiguity, but it never gets perfect. It's like looking for absolute zero in temperature or absolute zero in air pressure. It's something you can asymptotically approach, but you never really get there. And somewhere along the lines, you say, hey, that's close enough. That answer is good enough. Good enough is good enough. Doesn't have to be perfect. Maybe the
repeater, timeout.
As you can see, Wes, that's a whole bunch of opinions of what worked for me. And so, I didn't say it's easy, but you've got the right test equipment, you've got the capability, properly applied, could do some magic if you wanted to bad enough. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, thank you very much for that explanation. So, what popped to my mind is that the FCC put the restriction on the manufacturers to give the gain value for the particular antenna, and that might be for the reason that at first they are cheating, at second, FCC wants all of the money. So my question to you is now, if the guys go to the properly accredited lab and they do the measurement, would they then be allowed to give the gain value? Also, the Japanese manufacturers, the Diamond is one of them, they don't care, they give you the gain right off written on the antenna, to share.
Yeah, there are people who want FCC verification of an antenna performance. In the case of an antenna put on the front end of a handheld radio frequency identification interrogator or reader, that antenna is allowed to have gain up to and including 6.0 dB of gain, and you're not allowed to go beyond that. Total radiated power going into that antenna is allowed to be up to 1.0 watts, and you're not allowed to go beyond that. And so, if you've got an antenna, and you've got a transmitter that's part of your RFID reader, and now you want FCC certification, one of the laboratories that people go to is Retlif, I think it's the word filter spelled backwards, Retlif. Retlif in Bohemia is one of the places that is qualified to do that kind of testing traceable to the Bureau for you. However, I've been there. I've seen that testing. It's done on a kind of a outdoor antenna range, which really consists of a fiberglass building, because you want to put your instrumentation inside of a fiberglass building because you don't want it rained on. And even though the building is made out of non-conducting materials, you're getting reflections off the wall of the building. So it is a good antenna range. It's not an excellent antenna range. And so how close is the measurement to the truth is an interesting question. And so as you can tell, outdoor antenna range testing is what you're forced into if you blow 1,000 megacycles. And there's a whole art and science to doing it. If this is the best of all worlds, your outdoor antenna range is a completely flat surface with no other absorbing, reflecting, or refracting
repeater. Time out.
No other refracting or absorbing or reflecting objects nearby, which means it really is outdoors, and you pray for good weather. You put it in any kind of an insulated building made out of fiberglass, and you're contaminating 11 daylights out of the measurement, in my opinion. So, it ain't easy. Study that chapter by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, of Bell Laboratories, now a silent key, in the appropriate chapter of the ARL antenna book, and it's a simple looking article, but if you understand what the hell's going on there, he comes the closest to the truth of anybody I know of on VHF antenna range performance measurements. And so it's not necessarily expensive. You could do it if you wanted bad enough. You can do it, Wes. There was somebody else who had a question or a comment. Who was that? K2IW, the tech man?
K2IW, KC2, I'll speak. Quick comment.
Okay, if you said it a little bit faster, I wouldn't get a single letter of your call letters. Try that again, sir. You're not in the big rush. K2RIW, go ahead.
This is AC2IS. The question I got from a friend a little while ago.
AC2IS, go right ahead.
Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra. And the question is, if you've got a magnet, is it possible to focus the magnetic waves from the magnet in a similar way that you do with an RF signal? And then what would it take to do that? Is it possible to make something like an iron lens that might focus the magnetic waves coming off of a magnet? AC2IS.
I'm waiting for the beam, but I guess you're coming in by the eastern input. Very fine, Bill. When it comes to a radio wave that's been transmitted into free space, you can focus that radio wave by radiating it from a feed horn into a parabolic dish, for instance, and the reflection of the parabolic dish does a beautiful job of taking your spherical wavefront, converting it into a planar wave, which gives you the highest directivity you're going to get, the highest gain you're going to get for that diameter of parabolic reflector. You can also do the opposite. You can take that feed horn and plug it and aim it at a dielectric lens, something that literally looks like a magnifying glass, but it's made out of foam. And you have various thicknesses of foam to make a magnifying glass, and you can make a phony foam, a phony magnifying glass. Let me drop it. By taking a chunk of foam and burying metallic washers into it, and each of those washers are smaller than a wavelength in size, but you change the density of the washers, in other words, how many washers per square inch, so to speak. You have a thicker density in the center of this lens and a thinner density out at the edge, and you make a phony dielectric that acts exactly like a magnifying glass. So there's various ways you can reflect, diffract, and reflect, refract, diffract, and reflect radio waves by dielectric materials and conducting materials. You can even go one step beyond that by way of artificial, radio frequency selective surface. There's a whole science called frequency selective surfaces, FSS, where you can now make a sheet of metal with slots in it, or a sheet of plastic with little chunks of metal in it of just the right size, and you do a step and repeat. And now you can do various kinds of frequency selecting. At certain frequencies, the signal will be reflected. At certain frequencies, the signal will go through. At certain frequencies, the signal will be bent to some other shape, focused in whatever, by frequency selective surfaces. So by passive techniques that I'm describing, of just conductors and non-conductors placed in the correct positions, made of the right sizes, in three-dimensional space, you can do all those three things with radio waves. Reflect, refract, and diffract. Let me drop.
Dick, it might be possible he was talking about permanent magnets.
I know that, and I'm getting there. Now, that radio wave, 144 megacycles, when it sees a steady magnetic field, what does it do? Nothing. I can have a huge horseshoe magnet where between the ends of that horseshoe magnet, I get the strongest magnetic field in the world. And you're sending a radio wave through that area. And you think the radio wave is going to see the magnetic field and do something. The radio wave is going to see the metal of the tangs of the horseshoe magnet, and you're going to get reflections and diffractions off the horseshoe magnet, whether it's magnetized or not. But that magnetic field, which is not an oscillating magnetic field, that electromagnetic wave is flipping back and forth in voltage polarity or magnetic field polarity at right now 146 megacycles, and you put a steady state magnetic field in there, it is my best guess it will not see it. Now there's a catch. That's in air. If you now put the right kind of ferrite material across the poles of your magnet, yeah, now, because of the way ferrite material gets biased with a steady state magnetic field, and the ferrite material has a property called gyrotropy. You can look that up and study it. Gyrotropy is a kind of non-reciprocity of magnetic material. So a ferrite-like magnetic material with a steady-state magnetic field has one velocity of propagation from left to right and a different velocity of propagation from right to left. And so by ferrite materials properly placed inside of a thing that you and I call circulator or isolator...
Repeater, timeout.
In that case, the strength of the magnetic field and the gyrotropic resonance of the materials funny characteristics of saturation went on. Yes, now you can affect radio waves at various frequencies because of magnetic field. But it's not the magnetic field that's doing it. It's the way the ferrite gets biased with the magnetic field, and the way if you understand the way a Yig filter works, yttrium iron garnet, a Yig filter, in the presence of a magnetic field, the individual domains do what's called microscopic precession. And now that precession is polarization sensitive, and therefore it's very sensitive to the signal flowing clockwise versus counterclockwise, or left to right versus right to left. So it isn't the magnetic field operating on the radio wave itself. It's the magnetic field operating on this quasi-nonlinear magnetic material that gives you some peculiar characteristics, which could be called the meta effect, meta material effect. Let me drop it.
And I have a question in the chat.
So I wonder if you see what we're saying so far, Bill, because Bill's asking this original question. AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet. Let's see if I time. No, I didn't time out the instant repeater. It's still there. So, AC2IS, did we put you to sleep? I'm having some fun with him. K2RIW.
I'm looking up something called the magneto-optic effect. You did have some dropouts on the Eastern repeater, so I'm not sure I caught everything. But it seems like there is possibly some kind of an effect where you could focus magnetism coming out of a magnet. And I guess, you know, when I'm thinking in terms of an iron lens, and you're talking about a ferrite material, these things seem to match up, but at least I think they do. AC2IS.
Question. And let me follow through with Bill first. Turns out that a magnetic field will do some funny things with a radio wave if and only if that magnetic field is flowing through certain kinds of, I'm going to call it magnetic materials. Ferrite, for instance. Ferrite and iron powder and what, certain kinds of magnetic materials in the presence of a magnetic field do some peculiar metamaterial-like things, which can focus, refract, reflect, different velocities of propagation, left to right. It violates reciprocity. Air will not do that. The strongest magnetic field in the world, in air, won't do anything until you arc over the air and make the air into a non-linear material. So you think the magnetic field is doing it. Well, the magnetic field affecting the ferrite is doing it. The ferrite is really doing it. I wonder if that makes some sense, Bill. AC2IS, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I believe so, but you're mentioning RF, and the question is really, can you do this with a magnet like you would, you know, can you focus magnetism like you would an RF signal? So the question, you know, I'm not expecting the answer to involve RF. I don't know if there's some confusion there on my part.
Yeah, since the majority of the questions you and I talk to each other about, Bill, are radio questions, and I assume this was a radio question. Now you're talking about magnetic fields irrespective of radio, and if you're asking, can magnetic field be focused? Oh boy, can they? Can they do focusing? In the case of what goes on in the gun assembly of a cathode ray tube or a traveling wave tube, all the kinds of magnetic focusing of that electron beam can do all kinds of magic of converging, diverging, and deflecting, and so on. So magnetic fields can have all kinds of effects on charged particles that are moving, like electrons. Let me drop.
You were talking about massless particles.
Okay. If you want your magnetic field to deflect a neutrino, a massless particle, it ain't going to do nothing. Your magnetic field is not going to do nothing to a neutron. It's going to do all kinds of things to a proton that's moving or an electron that's moving. So I know too little about what I think you're asking. You want to do focusing and deflecting of something with magnetic fields, or you want the magnetic field itself to be focused with the right kind of materials and the right kind of permanent magnets and electromagnets. You can make any kind of shape, strength, and whatever a magnetic field you like. Not quite sure if that was your question, though. AC2IS, K2LIW.
Text EPC.
This is AC2IS. And yeah, the question is basically, if you have a permanent magnet, would it be, you know, can you form essentially an iron lens? Would it look like a lens, kind of like an optical lens, if you wanted to focus the magnetism of that permanent magnet, AC by S.
Okay, let me make a guess as to what I think you're asking. By some means, you're generating a magnetic field. And to put it in the terms of a radio field, I'm mixing terms here, and I'm being a little off to one side. You've got a certain equivalent, I'm going to call it power flux density. You've got a certain number of Gauss per square inch, so to speak. And now you want to put in there some kind of a structure that takes all that magnetic field that's across, let's assume that your magnetic field starts off being smeared across a 1 meter surface. And now you want to do something to take that 1 meter square surface that has a uniform magnetic field, and now you want to focus that magnetic field down to a point, and you want the magnetic field to get stronger as you point it, as you focus it down to that point. Is that possibly what you're trying to do, Bill? AC2IS, K2LIW.
Not really focused to a point, but I guess project the magnetic field of a magnet as far out in one direction as possible. AC2IS.
The exact wording you use for that question is absolutely not. In the case of a radio wave, I can focus that radio wave with something like a parabolic dish or a Yagi antenna, and I can send that radio wave out into space 12 billion miles, as Voyager is doing right now. I can really focus that wave and send it in one particular direction. Can you do that with a magnetic field? Absolutely not. Every magnetic field is a completely closed path. It ain't going to go out there to infinity. It's going to go some distance beyond the end of your bar magnet, so to speak, and it's going to curve around, and you could say the magnetic field, let me drop. You could say the magnetic field flowing out of the north end of your bar magnet, every single one of those lines is going to go out there in space a short distance. It's going to curve around and go back into the south end of that bar magnet. Every single line of magnetic field is a completely closed path. You cannot force them to be an open path. You're trying to make a unipolar magnet, so to speak. Every magnet is a dipole or beyond. You cannot make a point source of magnetic field. If you could, yes, you could send this magnetic field out into infinity of space. If you want to generate a real strong magnetic field on the Earth, and you want to focus it on the Moon, no way, Jose, is my understanding. Is that closer to what you're asking, Bill? AC2IS, K2LIW?
I believe that is what I'm asking, and I could see that, okay, maybe this can't be done, but I don't see from your explanation that it's impossible. It seems to me that you might be able to sort of squeeze the magnetic lines of force closer to the magnet on one side, and then maybe they would go further away from the magnet on the other side, or something like that. Not sure exactly how that would work, but maybe it's just not possible to focus magnetic waves from a permanent magnet to any real distance. EC2IS.
And I have a question in it.
I know. You use the word magnetic wave. Okay. We could talk about a magnetic field and magnetic field lines, so to speak. And yes, you could make a crazy shape of bar magnet where one end is blunt and one end is sharp, and so you'll get a different concentration of magnetic field, less magnetic field near the blunt end and a stronger magnetic field during the closer to the sharp end. But every single line leaving the north pole of the magnet, so to speak, is going to curve around in space and find itself back to the south pole. All magnetic fields are completely closed paths. Every magnet is at least a dipole. There is no unipolar magnetic field. In the case of electrostatic charge, let me drop. I can make a point source of charge. I can take some little dot and put some number of coulombs of charge on it, negative or positive, and lines of electric lines of force can branch out from that dot and go out to infinity in all directions. You cannot do that with magnetic field. I've now got a unipolar charge device. With charge, you can do that. All magnetic fields are in a closed path. And so you want to do something with a magnetic field on the Earth, and you want to launch it some great distance into space. Mother Nature ain't going to let you do that. That magnetic field, when it leaves any one of the structures of your launching system, it's going to be as fast as it possibly can, find the shortest possible magnetic path to go back to where it came from, so to speak, to complete the dipole. So transmitting a magnetic field in space, making an antenna pattern out of it, which has significant range. You want range of magnetic field. I can get huge range of a radio field and an oscillating magnetic field. But a steady state magnetic field with range, I think the answer is almost completely no, Bill, if I understand correctly what you're trying to do. AC2IS, K2LIW.
AC2IS here. I'd heard something about maybe this is how electron microscopes work, or maybe not electron microscopes, but for some sorts of microscopes that used magnetic fields in them to, maybe this is closer to the operation of the television that you're talking about, I hope, but maybe that you'd be able to use additional metal via magnetic fields to sort of focus magnetism, but yeah, maybe not. I may have that confused with something else. AC2IS, and I think I'm going to be on the side after this.
Just producing massless particles with mass-carrying particles.
In the case of moving charged particles, protons, electrons, or whatever, and you're making them curve into a path like in the Large Hadron Collider, or you're making them focus down to a very narrow beam in the case of a traveling wave tube, or you're making them focus into a very narrow beam, which you then deflect left and right to make a raster scan up and down for the electron gun assembly of a cathode ray tube. So magnetic fields can do all kinds of fancy focusing of the trajectory of charged particles that are moving. So Faraday's law tells me, let me drop. Faraday's law tells me if I've got a magnetic field and a charged particle that's moving in that magnetic field, by the right-hand rule of where you set up your index finger, your middle finger, and your thumb, all at right angles to each other, and you use one of those for the direction of the magnetic field, one of them for the direction of the charge particle velocity, and the third one is the force that's generated. You get this right angle law, which is Faraday's law, of moving magnetic field, of moving charged particles. And you can set up that magnetic field to move those charged particles in very complicated manners, as they do in the case of the Large Hadron Collider, in the case of some cathode ray tubes, and more elaborate things that are like a cathode ray tube. So moving charged particles in the magnetic field, you can do all kinds of fancy focusing and deflecting. But the magnetic field itself, can you now focus and transmit it as a steady state magnetic field? No. As a rapidly changing magnetic field that's part of a radio wave? Yes. But a steady state magnetic field focusing and getting real range out of it? I think the answer is no. Is that getting closer to what you're asking, Bill? AC2IS, K2LIW?
Yeah, Dick. I mean, I keep on hearing, I think, the consistent, like, no, that's not going to work, which could very well be. But the kind of microscope I was thinking of was a quote-unquote magnetic force microscope or a magnetic resonance microscope, AC2IS.
When it comes to a scanning microscope, electron microscope, you're using fancy magnetic fields to direct charged particles at the device you're trying to image. It's also tunneling microscopes, in other words, scanning tunneling microscope, the so-called tunneling effect, when you've got extremely small microscopic distances between a very sharp probe with a small voltage on it, scanning in an XY manner across a surface, you can get a kind of visualization of where the individual atoms and molecules of the surface are located. You're not really getting an image of it, but you're getting something that looks like landscape. So, once again, those machines do use magnetic field in some cases for focusing the trajectory of the charged particles that are doing the imaging for you. But and by the way, those charged particles are moving in a vacuum to do that. If you now want to move your charged particles, which are atom size or microscopic size, you know, they're what's the word I'm looking for? Molecule. But they're molecular in size or atomic in size. And you're moving those charged particles through a magnetic field. Almost always you're doing that in a vacuum. You try to do that in air, and you'd be amazed how dense air is. Your little charged particles are going to be crashing into those air molecules, and they ain't going to do anything like what you want them to do. So, alrighty. Both Hal and Wes, in reverse order, had further comments or questions on this. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
A related question to the...
That sounds like... we'll get to you. Go ahead, Wes.
That was Alan.
Okay. Yeah, I couldn't think of his name.
You actually attracted me with the subject discussed. When you were talking about the gyroscope in the ferrite, and you said, okay, magnet doesn't do any changes to the electromagnetic wave. Well, the ferrite, depends on the frequency, may aggravate the polygenic defect, causing introduced vortexes. And that comes in the microwave regions. And then when you were talking about microscopic precession, that would be another phenomenon that is attached to the previous one, if I'm not mistaken. And that would be electrical spin precession in microscopic spin wave. And you're gonna see that spin precession. And then when you talk about, when the gentleman was talking about magnet optic effect, there is something like that. And that's magneto optic effect in any of the number of the electromagnetic waves that propagates through the medium that has been altered. So, My primary question to you in this matter is, we have a magnet that affects the alignment of the dipoles in the ferrite. Is that how the circulators are being working? And why then the electromagnetic wave is kind of interacting with the structure of the ferrite that is temporarily magnetized and it's still closed loop? And to achieve.
Okay, you're now getting into an area that I'm pretty light on smarts. I don't really know. In the case of the magnetic precession that takes place inside of a yttrium iron garnet filter, a YIG filter, and the way that it has very precise frequency selectivity characteristics, and I've worked with those for quite a few years, I have some understanding of what's going on with the precession of the magnetic domains inside of a YIG filter. And what's nice about a YIG filter, let me drop it, is that once you learn the property of your particular material, the YIG sphere, the little bitty microscopic, you know, it's a very small sphere suspended in two right angle coils that in turn is suspended in a magnetic field. The nice thing about a YIG filter is that it's got extreme linearity. If you know the magnetic field and the frequency of resonance at one point on the graph, and you simultaneously know every other point, you double the magnetic field in absolute numbers, you double the frequency of resonance in absolute numbers. It's an extremely linear device, which starts off at the origin of the XY plot in the lower left-hand corner, and you draw a straight line of just the right slope, and you know the magnetic field and the frequency of resonance everywhere along that line with ridiculous linearity. It's an extremely linear device with one catch. There's a magic frequency below which it doesn't work. The YIG filters I work with work between 1.8 gigahertz and 18 gigahertz inclusive. Extremely linear in that frequency region. And you take, let me drop. You take that magnetic field and the points of resonance on that graph and project that line all the way back to zero. Zero magnetic field and zero hertz. It moves extremely linearly along that line, but there's a catch. The line stops existing below 1.8 gigahertz, roughly. A whole bunch of other crazy phenomena starts taking place. So as long as you're above that magic number, 1.8 gigahertz approximately, after that it's extremely linear because of the way the magnetic field in the individual domains precesses. If you increase the magnetic field, you increase the precession rate, and it's the precession rate that's creating the coupling between the two coils that are at right angles around this YIG sphere. And so, very fancy phenomena. And you get some extremely high Q, very useful filters out of that. And the filters we were using had three poles. In other words, if you put your microscope on the center of this filter, you open up the magnetic structure and you look inside, you see three little black spheres, each one of them is around 10,000th of an inch in diameter, and that three-pole filter would give you skirt selectivity of better than 80 dB. You get this beautiful curve of frequency passband, and the skirts of that filter go down 80 dB with very little undesirable responses. So when you put that YIG filter in front of a spectrum analyzer and you want to have single responses on all the frequencies you want to look at with that spectrum analyzer between 1.8 gig and 18 gigs, properly designed that YIG filter into a spectrum analyzer. Let me drop it. That spectrum analyzer will have no image response. It'll have real, but no image, and essentially no spurious responses and no harmonic responses. You can now look at signals between 2 gigs and 18 gigs inclusively. In other words, on the screen, you're doing a display of radio signals between 2 gigs and 18 gigs simultaneously displayed on that screen, and the first 80 dB of that display is real. No images, no phony responses, no harmonics. To me, that's magic. It's way beyond any of the filters you use by any other means. So that's my experience with gyrotropic and the Yake-like materials in the magnetic field. There's all kinds of other fancy phenomena that goes on in the case of a magnetically switched circuit that they use in radars. And there I've got almost no experience. I've heard people doing it. I've heard them talk about it. I only barely understand what the hell they were talking about. Let me drop.
KC2QRQ with a comment.
Yeah, we've got three people lined up. Hal was one, and Alan's another one. Hal, did you want to add something to this? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. You know what happened? I didn't have my clocks wound up right, and that's why I wasn't in on the beginning of the tech then. Am I getting in okay, Dick?
You're sounding beautiful. And I hear tell you're running over 100 watts these days. Go ahead.
I have 160, 180 watts we're putting out in the mobile. All right, go back to the tech net. I just wanted to let you know about why I wasn't getting out.
I understand. Okay, the next person you said, next person on the list to blame you is Al, AC2RFN. Alan, go ahead with your comment, and then we're going to pick up Glenn in that order. Alan, go right ahead.
Okay, the KC2RFN. My question is much simpler than what you've been talking about. When I was in my radiology residency, there was an MRI machine, 1.5 Tesla, which means it put out 1.5 Tesla magnetic field, constant magnetic field, which was used for the MRI, the imaging. And I recall that they had some sort of shield between the outside waiting room and the MRI suite itself. And I never quite understood how this, quote, shield, which looked like the hull of a submarine, but not very thick, blocked or attenuated the magnetic field. It wasn't like some thick piece of metal or, you know, a thick cinder block or anything like that. I don't know how it did it. Now, my understanding is it was a passive thing. When I asked the MRI technician how it worked, he had no clue. So I was wondering if anybody here might know how that actually attenuates a magnetic field, because I didn't know that you could attenuate a magnetic field without distance, that is, or maybe some very, very, very thick materials. Dick?
Yeah, you've used some good common sense in the words you just said, Alan. There is this magic material called mu metal, which usually is made out of fairly thin sheets, and it does do an extremely good job of magnetic shielding. You would think it's purely shielding. Not necessarily. Every one of those lines coming out of the north pole of a magnet are going to go back to the south pole of the magnet. And if the only path you've provided in air, they're going to travel through the air in very predictable paths. But if somewhere along that air path you say, I don't want any magnetic field, but I've got to have that magnet, that bar magnet's got to be located there, but in this little chunk of space where there normally would be some magnetic field, I don't want any. You're going to supply a shield made out of mu metal. Those lines of force, look at that mu metal, and mu metal has a mu of something like 1,000 or maybe even 5,000. In other words, the magnetic field flows through this mu metal 1,000 times better than air. It's a little bit like creating a short circuit. You've got your battery supplying a voltage to your light bulb, and somebody comes along with a real heavy piece of copper that connects across the two wires going to the light bulb. You create a short circuit, and those electrons will say, hey, to go through the light bulb, that's a 10-ohm circuit. To go through the short circuit that somebody supplied, that's only a milliohm, 99.9% of the electrons are going to go through that short circuit. That's exactly what you're doing with mu metal. You're magnetically providing a short circuit in space. And those magnetic lines will flow through the mu metal, and your device you want to protect that's on the other side of the mu metal doesn't see the magnetic field anymore. You've now cut it down by roughly 1,000 to 1 in this example. And there's various ways you can set up the geometry of that mu metal. Let me
repeater, timeout.
Now, one of the places where mu metal is frequently used, and where we did use it, is that we had this beautiful 200 watts worth of power transformer in the spectrum analyzer that supplied the plus 15 volts, the minus 15 volts, the plus 18 volts, the plus 5 volts, the plus 5,000 volts and whatever. this transformer is supplying all of these voltages. It had all kinds of turns in it. But because the manufacturer was using metal for the EI laminations of the transformer, that's a little bit lower in quality than it should have, the transformer had a significant amount of external magnetic field. That external magnetic field got picked up by the voltage-controlled oscillator that's part of the circuitry of the spectrum analyzer, and you had 60-cycle hum on that voltage-controlled oscillator. We had to shield that transformer. There's no way we could move it outside the cabinet. Let me drop. Good common sense would be that you, if I was trying to shield radio circuits, I would put a copper six-sided box around the device and make sure all the corners of the box are well soldered. You do that with a copper sheet of reasonable thickness copper around your transformer, and you solder up all the corners, and you find out you've lowered the magnetic field by 3 dB. I need 30 dB of decrease of the magnetic field, and I've lowered it by 3 dB when I put this great big thick copper box around the transformer. What's going on is that every conducting surface has a skin depth depending on what frequency. When you get down to a frequency as low as 60 cycles, the skin depth of the signal of your 60 cycle field penetrating the copper, it probably goes an eighth of an inch into the copper. So copper shielding of a magnetic field almost doesn't work. But you take a few thousandths of thickness, a few thousandths of an inch of thickness of this mu metal, because the magnetic field flows through it a thousand times better than it does air, it does a beautiful job of shielding. It's magnetically creating a short circuit, not really a shield. It's a short circuit. The exact same magnetic field is coming out of the plus end and the minus end of that, the north end and the south end of that magnet. You're just directing, you're providing a short circuit in space with this mu metal that directs where the magnetic field goes, and now you think you've shielded it, you've directed it away from your circuit that's vulnerable. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the tech net.
So, I get it. So instead of shielding it, you just make it want to run another way. And I guess in essence, you've taken the atmospheric resistive load off of that 1.2, that 1.5 Tesla magnet. And I wonder if in doing so, the magnet is becoming more efficient or needs less power to keep doing what it's doing. And since in an MRI, you want the field to be as steady as possible, stable as possible. And I imagine as they have a specific geometry to the field, I wonder if the shield throws off the field and they had to calibrate or adjust for it.
I think there's a yes and a no this one, Alan. How far away from the MRI machine was this so-called magnetic field? If it's half a room away, the MRI doesn't see it. If you took that mu metal and tried to put it down the center of your MRI where the patient would go, you'd have the problem of what happens if you put an oxygen bottle in the room. It'll get sucked into that center of that MRI so violently that if any human being was there, they probably wouldn't survive. The same thing would happen with the mu metal. The mu metal is a strong magnetic concentrator, so to speak. You take a chunk of that mu metal, and you hold it in your hand, and you slowly start walking toward the center of that MRI machine. You better hold on real tight. You're about to take a flight. Over to you, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW.
That's some image, Dick. Well, it was designed to shield the people in the outer room where they are going to take off as much metal as they can before they went in there. I imagine it also served maybe a last chance for people with pacemakers to realize what's going on and not walk through. But that was its design, was to limit the field from reaching into that part. But I would say that wall was about, it's been a while, but I'd say it's about 6 feet from the machine itself, and about, I guess that would be 6.5, 7, about 7 feet, 7 feet change from the center of the magnet itself.
Okay, you've now got another problem here, Alan. You've made a shielded wall, which is not six-sided, and even if it was six-sided, you've got a problem. The shielded wall, the good news is it's providing a magnetic short circuit. But just like the fact that you make sure you don't have an oxygen bottle in that room, and as you know, somebody was killed by one of those ones. It broke away and flung itself in the middle of the machine. And by the way, you can find a YouTube video where people are throwing things into a, you know, into an MRA machine, and boy, is it violent. You've got the problem of, even if the wall, let me drop the call. I am guessing this wall is made out of mu metal. It's the only thing I know of that really does what you call magnetic shielding, but it's really magnetic short circuiting. That wall better really be tied down really well, because if some way it can break away and be sucked into that machine, you know what would happen with an oxygen bottle, and the wall could do the same thing. But now you've also got the reverse problem. In the presence of that MRI machine with a strong magnetic field, if your MRI machine is not extremely well tied down, it will fly toward the wall. In either case, when those two things come together, you've got an awful lot of destructive power there. Magnetic fields can really get destructive in environments like this, and 1.5 Tesla is a lot of magnetic field. Over to you, Alan, K2RIW.
Oh yeah, Dick, there was no joke when you were going to go into that machine. You went through two levels of checkpoints before you were brought in there. You didn't just say, hey, come on in and just make sure you're not wearing a bracelet. There was a checklist that you went through, and you went through two stations. It might have even been a third station, but one of them was behind that shield. And one thing that I recall was that that shield was very well secured. It wasn't like tinfoil laid up onto the wall itself. It was a brand new self-supporting structure in of itself. I think the wall could have collapsed around it, and that structure would still be standing. And I assume the MRI machine was very well secured to the ground. I don't recall even looking. Although I had occasion to fix parts of it a few times, which is another story. But I remember that shield was solid as a rock. It was standalone, just inside the suite. And you're right, it never occurred to me that those two were pulling on each other. But I guess there was a reason that they had to have it. Maybe it was just the overall size of the suite, and they didn't have the real estate to take advantage of space. I assume it's an inverse square law. Is that true, too? The inverse square law of the magnetic field. They may not have had that real estate, so they probably had to throw in the shield.
In the case of magnetic fields of a transformer, it falls off by inverse cube law. Again, it's the magnetic field trying to close those lines. It's not like transmitting a radio wave or transmitting a light beam, so to speak. A shielded transformer, the magnetic field, or even not shielded, the magnetic field falls off by inverse cube law. Have you also noticed that almost all MRI machines, the patient is put onto, I'm going to call it a kind of a conveyor belt, which once you lock down the patient's head, if that's what you're measuring, in some kind of a structure so he doesn't move during the measurement, and you put him on this conveyor belt, and then you turn on the motor, and the conveyor belt slowly backs the patient or moves the patient into the MRI machine. You know why that's a conveyor belt that's run by a motor, and it's not just a human being pushing the another human being that's the technician sliding the human being into the machine? It's done by a precisely speed and motor. Do you know why that's done, Alan? KC2RFN, K2RIW.
Well, the first one that comes to mind is that, say you can get the proper longitudinal slices or axial slices, but I imagine the machine is steering that, so I don't know why.
Okay. If you put a person on that sliding shelf, and you're in a hurry, and you, the technician, slide him in the machine rapidly, what do you think would happen to the human?
Induce a current or heat him up?
You're getting close. It turns out the saline-like solution that your brain is bathed in, it turns out the conductivity of human blood is almost exactly identical to the conductivity of seawater. Extremely conductive fluid. So that all of those arteries and veins in that head is really three-dimensional wiring, like coils. And when you take a conducting coil or conducting wire-like thing and you move it into or out of a changing magnetic field, you will induce voltage, very predictable amount of voltage by Lenz's law. You move that patient into that machine fast enough, you are doing the equivalent of giving him electroshock therapy. Various portions of his brain now have voltages being introduced. Those voltages being coupled to that brain are going to give him psychedelic effects, disorientation effects, and whatever. When you move him into that machine, the rate at which you move him generates how many volts are all those conductors generating. You move him in there too fast. In theory, you could kill him. At a bare minimum, you're going to give him a psychedelic effect, and maybe you're going to give him electroshock therapy of an uncontrolled manner. Over to you, Alan, K2RIW.
And of all the precautions we were trained to be aware of, that was never one of them, Dick. I never heard of that before. That certainly makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, be careful. One of the reasons why you lock down the patient's head, not only to keep him steady during the measurement, if he starts getting excited and waving his head back and forth violently, he can get into a feedback mechanism where he twists his head real fast. That induces a voltage in his brain, which creates the equivalent of a command to his muscles. The muscles then moves the head, and you could end up with a positive feedback system where he ends up shaking his head back and forth against the walls of the machine. Over to you, Alan, K2RIW.
I can't say with the thousands of MRIs I've witnessed I've ever seen that happen, nor have I ever heard of it happening. Have you actually heard of this happening?
I'm telling you that in the case of a very strong magnetic field, if the patient moves rapidly, he can get all kinds of crazy effects. If you really are properly training that patient, and if his head is not locked down, you're going to tell him if he moves, he better move slowly. If he twisted his head clockwise and counterclockwise very rapidly, and he induces those voltages into those conducting materials that are in his head, he will be giving himself a kind of electroshock therapy. Over to you, Alan, K2LIW.
This electroshock therapy is supposed to be a calming effect. I can't say I've seen that much on MRI patients. Most of the time they get pretty wound up, but I've never seen any of them really move. I've never even really seen them try to get out of the machine. I've seen that in CAT scans a few times, but I haven't seen it with MRs.
In the case of a CAT scan, it's because the machine is making so much noise, they want to be out of there, or they're getting claustrophobia. Is that what you're saying, Alan? Go ahead.
You can remember a lot of these people are already stressed out for the reasons they're going in for a CT or an MRI to begin with. And the CTs are usually much more shallow. You know, they're really not that wide anymore. They're not really a tunnel like the MRIs are. And that freaks some people out. I've been in those machines, I've been in the MRI machines, and I fall asleep in them. The noise the magnet makes when they're scanning, I found very comforting. I can fall asleep to it. But many other people just freak out. They have a real hard time with it.
Have you ever had a patient in an MRI machine afterward complain of a slight amount of disorientation or psychedelic effects?
Never a psychedelic effect, but many times, they would say they feel a little disoriented. And I always thought that was just hypostatic, orthostatic hypertension, you know, just from lying down and relaxing for a long time and then getting up very quickly. But it may be the phenomenon you're talking about, and we're just not recognizing it. But yeah, it happens quite often.
Yeah, my wife is one of those people who came out of that machine and sensed a significant amount of disorientation. I'm not quite sure how long it lasted. But they make machines for industrial applications that go up to, I think, either 3 or 4 Tesla. And one of those machines was installed at Brookhaven Laboratory, I believe. And I talked to the guy who did that installation, and he told me that when he moved his head near the machine, he found out that he'd better move slowly, otherwise he felt some peculiar effects. But when his head was in the strong magnetic field, he could taste the fillings in his mouth. And he's not the only person that said it. I'm not sure it's psychosomatic. I think there's something funny going on there. Over to you, Alan. K2LIW.
I think some people are more sensitive than other people. I haven't heard the tasting of their fillings. They're probably more worried about their fillings. A lot of people go in and they ask, you know, I have my filling, I have fillings in, and will my teeth be pulled out? So that's probably where that one's coming from, is my guess. But I think it's legitimate because a lot of people come out a little more disoriented than they went in, a little more not themselves. And I know the kinds. I know some of these patients, and the ones who are just not that interested in what's going on around them. So it's not psychological. You know, they really are a little disoriented. And they just mention it casually, not even thinking it's related to the machine. These are, like I said, people who are just very easygoing or not concerned about what's going around them. And they used to make those comments that they weren't quite themselves. Or you'd have to help them more, you know, out of the machine more than in the machine. But I never had the presence of mind to see how long it would take for them to get over the effects or come up with some sort of simple test to see how much they've been affected. If I knew then what I know right now, I could have had them do a very simple test just to see how coordinated they are, maybe check memory, things like that. Would have been an interesting study, Dick.
Commenting on Whitey White?
Yeah, Whitey White recognized. In other words, up till now, you thought because he was laying down for a while and then getting up fast, that was the disorientation. Yeah, there's a little bit of that, but I think there's something more going on here. I think it's Hank, N1YDY, KGRIW.
You got Glenn also.
Cancer survivor. And I've had a number of both MR studies, CT studies, PET studies, and I had the occasion to comment to my oncologist that it was more difficult to sit up from a CT than to get down onto the bed. And the gentleman was actually aware of that and said that it was something that he'd heard from a number of his patients but had never actually taken the time to measure or to investigate.
Yeah, I think there's something there that should be investigated. I know that Glenn has been standing by and wanted to say something. KC2QIQ, I wonder if you worked with MRI machines, Glenn. K2LIW. Yeah, you're pretty much spot on with a lot of stuff, Dick. Just a couple of quick things I wanted to throw in, a couple of quick notes. One is mu metal. Mu metal is a nickel iron alloy. Basically, how it works is if you have electromagnetic lines of flux that are static and they're coming out from a magnetic source, it doesn't short out the lines of flux. What it actually does is it's a very high permeability, not 1,000 times, not 2,000 times, not 3,000 times. It's usually somewhere in the order of 100,000 times. It's a very, very high permeability nickel-iron alloy. And what does that mean? That means that if you were to draw the lines of flux coming out of the north end, returning back to the south end of the magnet, what would happen is they would be very well spread out the further and further they get away from the source. Now, what happens, once these magnetic lines of flux, if the mu metal is tangent to these electromagnetic lines of flux, what it does is it recombines them and pulls them all together. It kind of tucks them in nice and tight. So what happens is when the electromagnetic lines of flux reach that wall, they kind of all get reunited again, pulled together like where they were near the source, and then pass out the other end. So what it does is it kind of shapes the electromagnetic field. We need another drop. The other comment I wanted to make was electromagnetic fields and their size and how far they can go in distance. Well, here again, it's very dependent. The size of an electromagnetic field and its intensity, this depends on the source. If you theoretically had a superconductor with infinitesimally small resistance in the coil and infinitely large amount of current that you could plug through this coil, and you kept on increasing it to theoretically infinity, you'd not only pass the moon, you'd be beyond the moon. I mean, is that practical? Heck no. But the reality is generally the size and the proportion of an electromagnetic field is usually pretty directly proportional to the H field that you're producing, which is typically in a electromagnetic determined by the amount of current and the amount of turns in the coil and how low you can keep the resistance so it doesn't burn up. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
You brought up an interesting point. I didn't know the mu of mu metal is as high as 100,000. But mu really is a number which is the equivalent of magnetic resistance of the material with comparison to air. I think air is the reference. So if the mu metal had a mu of 100,000, my way of looking at that is the magnetic field flows through the mu metal 100,000 times better than air. Therefore, it's going to gather all those lines, like you said, because they really like going to the short circuit. It's a magnetic field short circuit in space, is my way of looking at it.